Way.
Welcome to WHFR, David Cobb.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'd like to know, how has your background and experience prepared you for the role of President of the United States?
Well, Susan, I'm the only presidential candidate in this election cycle who grew up in a house without a flush toilet. And I mean that simply but profoundly. I am the only presidential candidate who grew up in poverty. I'm the only presidential candidate currently without health insurance. In other words, I am a working class person and know and experienced firsthand what most Americans experience day in and day out. I worked myself through college, waiting on tables, washing dishes, working construction jobs, and working as a deckhand on shrimp boats in the small shrimping village I grew up in. As a result, I have the kind of firsthand experience on what it's like to be an American. The reality is that all the rest of the presidential candidates are wealthy, and most are millionaires. I am not. So I think that my life experience as somebody that mirrors what most Americans face makes me uniquely positioned to understand what ordinary Americans need out of their government.
What is the philosophy of the Green Party, and why did you decide to run as a Green Party candidate?
The Green Party is the only political party that is advocating and advancing a genuine progressive agenda. The issues that we work on all come out of our commitment to a core set of principles and values, which are commitment to racial and social justice, real democracy, ecology, and a commitment to nonviolence as a way to make systemic change. That's why the Green Party is the political party calling for an end to the war in Iraq and bringing our troops home now. The Green Party calls for a single-payer universal health care so that health care would be a fundamental human right in this country. The Green Party is calling for raising the minimum wage to a true living wage so that everybody enjoys the benefits of raising themselves above the poverty level to live in real dignity as a result of their own work and labor. The Green Party is calling for an end to the racist war on drugs and the prison industrial complex that's being created around it. We're calling for a repeal of NAFTA, an abolishing the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. You know, the Green Party really is calling for deep systemic change in this country, and that's the reason I chose to seek the Green Party's presidential nomination, in order to help to grow and build the fastest-growing political party in the country, that is the Green Party, a party committed to peace, racial and social justice, real democracy, and environmental protection.
When you say the Green Party is the fastest-growing party, how do you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, Susan, let's look at it objectively. In 1996, there were only 10 organized state Green Parties in the entire country. Only 5 of those states had a guaranteed ballot line, and there were 40 elected office holders at that time. In 2000, the Green Party had grown to 21 organized state Green Parties. 10 of those states had a guaranteed ballot line, and there were 87 elected Green Party office holders. And, of course, in 2000, we know that George W. Bush stole the election, and the Democratic Party leadership, rather than fighting to secure the election that their candidate had actually won, instead spent the entire time blaming the Green Party and calling us spoilers. And in that difficult climate, the Green Party continued to grow so that by 2004, the Green Party had 44 organized state Green Parties. 23 of those state Green Parties had a guaranteed ballot line, and there were 207 elected Green Party officials. So by every objective concrete number measurement, the Green Party is getting larger, stronger, and better organized. And of course, we're doing it against all odds. A situation where the Greens are excluded from the debates, where the corporate media attempts to ridicule and marginalize the Green Party effort, and most profoundly, we in this country live in and operate under a voting system where progressive voters are constantly told they have to vote against what they hate rather than for what they really want. And against that backdrop, more people register into the Green Party, more people run as Green Party candidates, and more people are getting elected as Green Party office holders every election cycle. Today, Best estimates are that there are 500,000 self-identified Greens across this country, and we're growing every single day.
When you say that you're attracting so many more people into your party, how is that coming about? I mean, are you active in all different communities in every state, or how is that coming about?
Well, Susan, we are in fact active in virtually every state, and almost every community has a local Green Party. And I would encourage your listeners to check us out on the web at www.gp.org. That's the Green Party's national website. And with just a few mouse clicks, you can find your state Green Party, and from there find your local Green Party chapter. And if there's not one, I would encourage any listener who's so inclined to actually help to create a Green Party chapter in your community. The reality is that Greens are ordinary citizens who are rolling up our sleeves to really do the extraordinary, which is to create a people's political party without being beholden to corporate interest, and create a political party to take our country back from the corporate fat cats who have hijacked it from us.
I'll just interrupt for a second, David and Susan. I happen to know that the Michigan Green Party office is actually located in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is only about 25, 30 miles west of Dearborn, where we're talking to you from, and in Detroit, Michigan, does have a very, very active chapter of the Green Party, and many candidates on the Detroit ballot for various positions. Although not so much in our suburbs right now, in the surrounding areas, but that's where they can look certainly, and gp.org. But back to you, Susan.
I'd like to ask some questions about our economy and domestic agenda, but I know that you are talking to us from California. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And I just have to ask you, what is going on in the political landscape in California these days?
What do you mean?
Well, are there any political issues that are different in California right now than some of the other states? And I know California often has its own agenda.
Well, I can tell you that California is a place where progressive politics is really taking root. The anti-war movement is very strong in California, and I think that's the issue that is attracting most of the interest in the citizen organizing, is opposition to this illegal, immoral, and unconstitutional war that the Bush administration launched and that John Kerry supports. All the anti-war organizing is an exciting reality. And I'm proud of the fact that the Green Party opposed the war before it began. I'm proud of the fact that the Green Party continues to oppose the occupation. And I'm proud to be a presidential candidate who says, in the occupation, support our troops by bringing them home safely now.
I also have to ask you how the new governor of California is doing out there.
Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a typical politician, notwithstanding his movie star status. Policies have not fundamentally changed from the corporatist Gray Davis, who was a Democrat. You know, I don't say it with any glee, but I certainly say it with certainty when I say that a typical corporatist Democrat and a typical corporatist Republican are not really that much difference. Of course, there are differences, but the real difference in politics these days is not between the leadership of the Democratic and Republican parties. There is a difference, but it's fairly minor. But the real difference comes between the rank-and-file Democratic Party members, who are infinitely more progressive than the leadership of their own party. And that's why I respectfully challenge folks who consider themselves progressive, and I presume that would mean most of the listeners of this fine community radio station, to ask yourself, if you support peace, racial and social justice, real democracy and environmental protection, don't you think you owe it to yourself to get involved with the political party that's advocating for those things?
Well, that's a good point. But I know there was a tremendous rage out there at Gray Davis, and he was voted out. I mean, are people overwhelmingly happy and overjoyed now that he's gone and feel that things are better? Or?
Susan, I don't think that certainly people are not overjoyed that he's gone. because he was replaced by Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, the again, there's not that there hasn't been that much difference between life under Gray Davis and life under Arnold Schwarzenegger. They are both part of the same neoliberal NAFTA, WTO, corporate-managed agenda.
Well, we're going to have to move on to our domestic agenda now, and I'd like to ask you about our economy. And as we all know, our economy went into a recession in March of 2001, and by all accounts, this has been a jobless recovery. Here in Michigan, workers are faced with one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. What would you do to improve these economic conditions?
First and foremost, the Green Party knows that to really unleash the creativity of the American people and to get us moving again, we must repeal the North America Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA has been an absolute disaster. We need to repeal NAFTA, get us out of that horrific agreement that has us in a downward spiral, a real race to the bottom for both wages, jobs, and environmental protections. And it wouldn't stop with NAFTA. We should also abolish the World Trade Organization and get the United States out of that corporate-managed situation. And while we're at it, completely revamp both the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So that would be step number one towards really changing the economic reality in this country. Step number two would be to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. Everyone who works ought to make enough money to raise themselves above the poverty level and live in real dignity as a result of their own work and labor. And by doing that, we would actually stimulate the economy across the country. More people would have money to be buying and spending, and that money would be able to circulate in the local community, in the local area. And then the third thing that we should be doing in order to stimulate the economy is to actually cut taxes on the working poor and middle America. Middle-income people are paying a disproportionately high share of income taxes, and we should be actually taxing the super rich at a fair level to increase the amount of money that working people have to spend. The last part of our domestic agenda on the economy would be to encourage local communities and states across this country to develop laws that would encourage the consumption and purchasing of goods and services within their local communities in order to ensure that local communities stayed vibrant, to encourage community-based economics and smaller businesses. The reality is that the entrepreneurial spirit of small business people has been the driving force behind economic growth. The large transnational corporations and the huge mega corporations have actually been a net loser of jobs over the last decade, whereas entrepreneurs and small business people have actually provided jobs. So we need to actually work to encourage that.
Mr. Cobb, this is Jay Cornick again, just jumping in here. First of all, I want to remind my listeners they are listening to an important statement by David Cobb, who is the presidential candidate of the Green Party of the United States. And this is a pre-recorded show, but we do hope to offer it to our listeners several times before the election as part of our coverage of ideas and information, as well as music. You can't get on any other channel. Wanted to ask you about, in regard to the corporations, Mr. Cobb, there was a movie, actually a book, first talking about the corporation, and it was an analysis of the corporation. If the corporation was a human being, it would have to be called psychotic.
That's correct. The film you're talking about is called The Corporation, An Analysis into the Dominant Institution of Our Time. It was directed by Mark Akbar, who is actually a friend of mine. Mark actually also directed and produced a movie your listeners may be familiar with called Manufacturing Consent. Mm-hmm. Actually, the work that I do with the local group called Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County is featured in the movie The Corporation, and my work is actually in that film.
Oh, great.
So I would encourage your listeners to check out The Corporation. It's a phenomenal film. And it does, in fact, show that according to World Health Organization standards and psychological testing, if the corporation is really a person, it is clearly a psychopathic person. Because it is destroying its own environment. It doesn't care about other people. It's a fascinating film, and I would urge listeners to check it out.
Isn't there a legal protection for corporations? Somehow this got started in the United States where the corporation is treated with the same guidelines as if it was an individual. In other words, freedom of speech and so on. And this is part of the problem,
as I understand it. It is part of the problem. And the reality is that our legal system is so perverted that corporations are considered persons under law with constitutional rights, allowing corporations to actually go into courts across this country and attempt to overturn democratically enacted laws at the local, state, and even federal level that attempt to control their conduct and attempt to abrogate some of the harm that they're causing across this planet. Now, it does go to show, and the Green Party understands, that we have a problem when our legal system is protecting the property rights of the wealthy elite and their corporations rather than protecting the human rights of ordinary citizens. So the Green Party is calling for a peaceful, nonviolent uprising of the people of the United States to understand that we have a flawed democracy. Democracy means the people rule. And today, the people are not making the fundamental public policy decisions in this country. Instead, those decisions are literally being made by unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs. And we've got to grapple with our need to really spark and create, nurture, and grow a movement in this country that will be as powerful as the abolitionist movement of times past, of the trade union movement, of the women's suffrage movement. You know, if we're going to have a democracy, we need to have a democracy movement. I like to point out that the most dangerous threat to democracy in this country is the mistaken belief that we already have one. So if any of the listeners would like to get involved in this movement, again, check out my campaign on the web at www.votecob.org. That's VOTECOBB.org. Or your local Green Party at www.gp.org.
You've done these interviews before. You know how important it is for people to tune in late to get the message over and over. Thank you for helping on that. I was just about to mention it again. Let's jump to the topic of the healthcare system and healthcare problems. Susan?
David Cobb, our healthcare system is in crisis, as we all know, with costs rapidly rising and 43 million Americans are uninsured. Do you think there's a way to provide more affordable and accessible health care to all Americans, including prescription drugs?
Susan, there is a solution, and it's simple and easy. It's called single-payer universal health care. The Green Party is the only political party that is calling for universal single-payer health care, and it is a model that works all over the world, throughout all of the industrialized world. Healthcare is considered a fundamental human right. Our neighbors to the north in Canada use the same model. It allows everyone to choose their own doctor. It allows doctors to actually practice medicine without the interference of the pharmaceutical corporations or the insurance corporate executives breathing down their throat. And it will reduce healthcare costs dramatically. Single-payer universal healthcare is a simple solution to this problem. It would provide access to health care as a fundamental human right to all, greatly reduce the costs simply by eliminating the role that pharmaceutical corporations and insurance corporations are playing today, and it would reduce drastically the bureaucratic paperwork that's in play now because of the insurance companies. And oftentimes doctors must deal with 10, 12, even 13 different health care insurance forms. And I think it's important to remember that this kind of universal single-payer health care model that we're talking about is already used in this country for those over 65. And, of course, Susan, I'm talking about the Medicare system. And I just want to ask listeners to think about, when is the last time you heard a group of 65-year-olds marching in the streets demanding that their health care be completely privatized and turned back over to the insurance companies. Of course, it's even funny to ask it that way, isn't it?
We haven't seen that, no.
We have not seen that, and yet we have a system in which 40 to 50 million Americans, depending on what studies you look at, do not have access to health care, and as much as 20% of the children in this country do not have access to health care.
Well, we
do.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The system is in crisis, and there's a solution, and the Green Party is proposing it.
If you were in the studio with us here, you'd see me gesturing wildly that I wanted to ask. In Detroit here, since we're right on the border with Windsor, Ontario, Canada, there's actually a lot of bus travel of seniors. They rent buses from their homes and their various care facilities, and they actually travel over there to buy their drugs in Windsor. There's quite a few, I understand, dozens of these buses that are doing that every day now. And do the Canadian system also, in the single-payer nationalized health care program, have similar drug coverage too?
They sure do, Jay, and that's the reason that our seniors and poor people and people who need pharmaceuticals are traveling by bus. And some of those bus lines, by the way, they're not just in Detroit going to Windsor. Literally, across the country, people are either going to Canada, and people in the southern states are now going to Mexico to get prescription drugs. Isn't it shameful in this country, the richest and wealthiest country on the planet, we have our poor people and elderly people who need prescription medications are renting buses and going to our neighbors to the north and the south? Shouldn't we have single-payer universal health care that includes prescription drugs in this country?
That's a good question. We should. Fed Chairman, we have to turn to another topic now, and we want to talk a little bit about the Social Security system. And Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan has warned that Social Security needs to be changed. However, others feel that the Social Security system is an enormously successful and solvent program that is being raided by politicians. How would you manage the Social Security system as president?
Well, Susan, I agree with those who call the Social Security system one of the great success stories of this government. I think it's important to note that the Social Security Administration was actually created as a result of a third party advocating for it, just as so many of the successful programs and proposals today. You know, I will come back to the Social Security Administration, but allow me to take a moment to point out that the abolition of slavery, women getting the right to vote, the Social Security Administration, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation laws, pure food and drug laws, ending child labor, the direct election of U.S. senators, the 40-hour work week, all of those proposals really make up the fabric of what we today would consider a just and compassionate society. And it's important to remember that that fabric was literally woven together by alternative so-called third parties before us. So today, if listeners want to live in a society that will end war as foreign policy, if they want to have single-payer universal health care, and if they want to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, if they want to repeal NAFTA, they really have to be willing to have the same courage and conviction of those before us and to be willing to vote for third-party candidates. Now, I did promise to come back to the Social Security question, and I think that it's important to understand that Social Security is working. It was designed in order to ensure that the retired and the elderly were not living in poverty, and it works. And it's working now because actually the money coming into Social Security, with just a few improvements and very slight modifications, it is solvent. However, unfortunately, unfunded mandates and other spending by politicians is literally raiding and looting the Social Security fund. So I have a solution. Tax the super rich, cut the bloated military budget by about $100 billion, refund Social Security, make some minor adjustments, and the system will continue for those of us who are still working.
I want to turn now to the national budget deficit. which is growing at an alarming rate. How can this deficit be turned back into a surplus?
Well, it's again, Susan, just as we just discussed, the problem is that the super rich are not paying their fair share. The super rich, their portion of taxes has been going lower and lower. Corporations are paying less and less in taxes. Many of the largest transnational corporations do not pay any tax at all by the time they finish with all the incredible tax loopholes. And it's important to understand that John Kerry is actually as well as George Bush, are both calling to reduce corporate taxes even further. The solution, tax the super rich. Those people making over $250,000 to $500,000 a year ought to be paying much, much more in taxes. We need to return to a progressive tax system in this country where people pay their fair share. And secondly, if we cut the military budget in this country, we could cut it by about $100 billion and still have a strong defensive military. And that's the way that I would address the growing budget crisis that we face.
There has been a new proposal during this presidential campaign, and that is the concept of an ownership society. Is this a concept that would work for most Americans?
Oh, Susan, not only would it work, but it would greatly improve the quality of life for the overwhelming majority of Americans. I'm proud of the fact that the Green Party supports that concept. And again, if the listeners would like to find out more about it, check us out on the web at www.gp.org, or our campaign can help you out. And our campaign is online at www.votecobb.org. But the concept of an ownership society says that we really all participate in creating our society, our government, and our culture, and that we ought to all collectively involve actively in participating in creating that society, enjoying the fruits of our collective labor, and that we really need to move in the direction that many of most of the European countries have moved into, which is a more vibrant public sector where we're actively engaged in the day-to-day decision-making process in this country.
We're almost at the halfway point in this wonderful in-depth interview with David Cobb, presidential candidate of the United States from the Green Party. And we thank you so much for giving us this time. It must be frustrating to you, the difficulty of getting your message out, of being excluded from the national debates frequently. Perhaps you'd like to comment on that briefly.
I would, Jay, and I want to start my observation with this. The only reason that your listeners are having the opportunity to hear this in-depth conversation with an alternative political party, even though, of course, the majority of things that we're talking about, the majority of Americans agree with, which is the real irony. But the only reason that they're even hearing this is because they're listening to a community-supported radio station so that they're not filtered by corporations and corporate media. You know, corporate media is literally manufacturing consent in this country. They're deciding what Americans are allowed to hear about and what they talk about. So this is a precious resource, and I really would urge listeners, even if you disagree with what I'm saying and with this conversation, that the next time Pledge Drive comes around, that you call and make a pledge to support this community-supported radio station, because it's really a valuable resource to allow you to hear alternative views and voices.
I appreciate that plug. It's very kind of you.
Well, it's also true, Jay. It's not me pandering.
Yes,
I understand the value of community radio, and I understand the importance of the growing media democracy movement that's taking place in this country. And I do want to come back to your point. You know, it's true that the corporate debates exclude both the Green Party and the Libertarian Party. Alternative voices are not heard on those debates, and they really are corporate debates. Most people continue to mistakenly believe that the League of Women Voters actually control those debates. They do not. A corporation was created by the Democratic and Republican parties called the Commission on Presidential Debates. That corporation receives its funding from Anheuser-Busch and Philip Morris. Literally, beer and tobacco money fund a corporation called the Commission on Presidential Debates, and it is charitable at best to call those debates, because both Bush and Kerry and their operatives literally negotiated camera placement, who the questioners are, what the format is, what questions we're allowed to be asked. They are really not debates. They are really infomercials. So don't fool yourself into thinking that you're about to watch real debates, because you'll see nobody will ask about universal health care. Nobody will ask or advocate in their questioning and challenge for a need to end the occupation of Iraq. No questions about a living wage will be asked. No questions about NAFTA and the disaster that it's had. You'll see that they are not actually debates. None of the questions will really challenge either of the two candidates.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to go to the next topic now.
I know that, David Cobb, you have talked a little bit during this interview about free trade, but I want to ask a question. Pat Buchanan, a former presidential candidate, has written a new book, and in his book he states that free trade and outsourcing are economic treason against the American worker. Do you think he's correct?
I'll tell you, I think that's one of the few occasions where I think Pat Buchanan is correct. I disagree vehemently with Pat Buchanan's position on most social issues and tax issues, but when it comes to outsourcing, when it comes to NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, he is right. It amounts to economic treason against American workers. And I think that it is shameful, and I think it is very telling that both George Bush and John Kerry are in absolute agreement on their claim that NAFTA is a success, their claim that the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund and World Bank and corporate managed trade is actually a success. And you know, Susan, the American worker and ordinary Americans know that NAFTA has been an absolute disaster, that outsourcing is a huge problem, and you can't really modify that with a few reforms. We've got to repeal NAFTA. We've got to abolish the World Trade Organization. We've got to return sovereignty to the people of the United States. We've got to engage in genuine fair trade rather than this corporate-managed system that's misnamed free trade. There's nothing free about it. It is tightly controlled to benefit the wealthy elite and the corporations and ensure that there is a downward spiral, a real race to the bottom for both wages and environmental protections. The Green Party is calling for a repeal of NAFTA and getting us out of the World Trade Organization.
If I can just ask a quick follow-up on that, even without NAFTA and other trade agreements, multinational corporations will still relocate their manufacturing to the third world countries, wouldn't they?
Well, you know, Jay, they wouldn't if we actually did what I was talking about earlier, which was empower local communities to forbid them to do it. You know, there's no reason that we have to allow these large transnational corporations to relocate their facilities this way. You know, when the earlier question that was asked about moving to a genuine ownership based society really underscores the idea that we, the people, have the power, should we choose to exercise it, to actually control our own economics. And that's what the Green Party is calling for, and that's what the Cobb-LaMarche ticket of the Green Party is saying. We need to not just repeal NAFTA and the WTO, but let's also empower local communities to forbid the closing of factories that would actually take our jobs overseas. We need to rethink how we think about economics in this country.
When you're talking about the Green Party concept or philosophy of an ownership society, I think that's one definition or interpretation of that phrase or concept or idea, and I think some of the other candidates may have a different take on what their concept of an ownership society may be.
Well, I think you're right, Susan, and I am proud to defend the Green Party's idea of an ownership society that says that those of us who are doing the work and the labor should actually enjoy the fruits of our labor. Currently, about 0.5% of this country controls over 50% of all the wealth and assets. That is atrocious. It's the income and wealth disparity in this country has never been greater since the age of the robber barons immediately preceding the last Great Depression. We are in a genuine crisis mode, and it's going to get even worse unless the American people demand change. And I'm asking the voters, don't just talk about the need for change, vote for change. The only way that we can actually get change is if you're willing to vote for candidates who are calling for change. And today, people know that the only political party advocating for systemic social change in this country is the Green Party. And I'm urging voters, register into the Green Party as a way to cast your vote every single day for peace, justice, economic fairness, real democracy, and environmental protection. And vote for Green Party candidates up and down the ballot, from president all the way down to school board, as a way to ensure that you can help to continue to grow the movement that the Green Party represents.
Well, David Cobb, I'd like to turn now to the topic of foreign policy, but before I do, I just have to squeeze one little question in here about the environment, and I have to ask you about something that's going on in Michigan, and that is the concept of the Great Lakes water diversion. And a lot of states in the Southwest are asking for some water from the Great Lakes.
Well, I think it's a huge and terrible mistake. The reality is that our development policies and programs in this country are profoundly misguided. The Green Party calls for sustainable economics and sustainable development. Sustainable means that we have to operate within the guidelines and within the physical reality of the fact that the Earth itself is a closed ecosystem, and that everything that we do must ultimately be sustainable, meaning that we understand that the world Earth's resources are not infinite. However, if we operate under a realization of the ever-changing cycle of the Earth, that we can literally live in harmony with our natural world. And the idea of diverting water from the Great Lakes all the way down to the Southwest is a profoundly stupid idea.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about foreign policy, since that seems to be such a major issue in this campaign. And we spent, as Americans, $41 billion on homeland security. Yet the U.S. still has a very serious problem with illegal immigration. Do you think this money was well spent, and how can we better secure our borders?
Well, you know, the money was not well spent. It was money that was, in fact, grossly misspent and grossly mismanaged. And I think that, George Bush and John Kerry are in absolute agreement on the Patriot Act, whereas the Green Party says the Patriot Act is a direct assault of the civil liberties of the people of the United States. And if we were really concerned about homeland security, we would begin to address the root causes of terrorism and the global insecurity. If we want global security, we need to change U.S. foreign policy and stop promoting and protecting the interest of a transnational corporate empire. Because, Susan, there really is an empire, but it's not an American empire based on American values of liberty, justice, and equality. Instead, it's a corporate empire based on corporate values of greed, exploitation, and oppression. The way to change it is to change our foreign policy, and this new foreign policy would eliminate the kind of international terrorism that we're seeing, because terrorists are not insane, crazy people who are just psychotic. They are people who are utterly desperate and see no way to affect any meaningful change outside murder And we need to address what those root causes are. So the biggest way to begin to move to global security today would be to end the occupation of Iraq and bring the United States troops home. And I've got a detailed plan if you'd like to talk about Iraq.
Well, we do want to turn to that, but I still am, you know, wondering, since we spent $41 billion on Homeland Security, why do we still have 3 million illegal immigrants coming over our border every year?
The reason that we have 3 million immigrants coming into this country undocumented is because of the desperate conditions in the global south. The reality is that if we, the people, would enact the Green Party's program of ending NAFTA, GATT, the World Trade Organization, what you'd see is slowly a stabilization process, because most of the people coming into this country as undocumented workers are leaving family, friends, and their own communities out of a sense of economic desperation. You know, we can change that by entering into genuine fair trade agreements that respect the workers and working conditions in the global south, especially considering that the overwhelming majority of undocumented workers in this country are actually coming from Mexico and Central America, fleeing the desperation that's being created by these international trade agreements. If we want to address immigration and illegal immigration, we have to address the root cause of that which is driving it. And that which is driving it, once again, corporate-managed international trade agreements that are devastating the conditions for working people, not just in this country, but the global south as well.
Yes, we should talk about Iraq, and how would you handle the Iraq situation at this point?
Well, Susan, let's start by acknowledging what the Green Party knew all along, that this was a terrible, terrible, illegal, immoral, and unethical war. And it was a war for oil. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There were no links between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. And the solution is both simple but profound. If David Cobb, Green Party presidential candidate, were elected president, let me tell you what my specific, concrete plan would be. And this plan, by the way, is detailed on my website at www.votecobb.org. Step one, if I'm elected president, the very next day on November 3rd, before I take office, I would issue a public apology to the people of Iraq for the war that George W. Bush declared on them and waged against the better interests and desires of the American people. Step two, I would immediately rescind every one of the corporate crony contracts that the Bush-Cheney administration has already entered into with Halliburton Corporation, Bechtel Corporation, and the rest of the transnational corporations. Step three, I would make the billions of dollars that have already been earmarked for those contracts, since the contracts would be rescinded, I would make those monies available to the Iraqi people and to Iraqi civil society directly, and I would call it what it really should be called under international law, and that is reparations. Make those tens of billions of dollars available to the Iraqi people so that they can rebuild their own country. Step three, I would enter into negotiation with Iraqi civil society leadership, not with the puppet government that is being created as a result of the Wolfowitz gang and Paul Bremer, but instead would actually enter into open negotiations with the Iraqi civil society and the civil society leadership under the auspices and the mediating factor of the United Nations, so that they would understand that the American troops under a Cobb Green Party administration are going to come home, and that if there is any need for a genuine peacekeeping force, that force should operate under the auspices of the United Nations, that those troops should come from the Islamic world, from troops who speak Arabic, to de-escalate the kind of clash of civilizations that the Bush-Cheney administration has created with this, and bring the troops home. Because, Susan, let's understand this. U.S. military presence in Iraq is not, they are not viewed as an army of liberation. They are viewed as an army of occupation. And you can really tell the difference, because an army of liberation is greeted by the people of the region with flowers and candy and and parades in the streets. That is not what's happening today. We need to get the U.S. troops home. But as I just outlined, there is actually a 4 or 5 step plan that can actually get the U.S. troops out now, and under that plan, we would be moving towards genuine global security and stability, not only in Iraq, but in the Middle East in general.
So those would be the major changes you would make to our military policy in relation to Iraq. What about the rest of our military policy? I know you've talked about reducing spending on military policy.
Well, I want to be clear. The Green Party and David Cobb are both absolute proponents of a strong defensive military. However, the current military policy of this country is anything but defensive. It is offensive in the extreme. And, of course, I mean that pun definitely intended, because we have a military policy that is both obnoxious and is used to assert power affirmatively throughout the world in order to protect the interest of these transnational corporate elites and the corporate interest. So the new U.S. foreign policy would really begin moving us in the direction of a whole new world, and would be creating the kind of stability and global security that would mean that there would not be the need for U.S. military troops to be all over the world. And I think that it would be very easy to begin to close military bases throughout the world, because we only need to if we're going to have a defensive military and actually have the United States be a partner and join the worldwide community, it doesn't require us to have military bases flung out all over the world. Instead, we just need to protect the shores of this country. We can do that easily by cutting $100 billion from the United States military and still have the strongest and most effective defensive military in the world.
Would you strengthen protection at our borders?
Well, to the extent that it was necessary in order to protect the shores of the United States.
But what about all these illegal immigrants coming through?
Susan, as I said, the undocumented workers are being driven by economic policies. They're not coming here to try to take over the United States. They are fleeing desperate economic conditions. And anybody who's concerned about undocumented workers, the solution is to change economic policy and international economic policy.
Let me jump in, David, and say we have about 10 minutes left in our interview, and we are speaking with David Cobb, who is the presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket right here in Michigan. He is one of the choices for your vote on November 2nd. This is WHFR.FM. I'm Jay Kornick, station advisor, and Susan Morrell here, but we wanted to conclude with just a couple of other detailed questions on the foreign policy issue. Mr. Cobb, how do you feel about the United Nations? Are they an effective organization? Is that the best way to become part again of the community of the world?
Absolutely. The United Nations is the best hope that we have in order to move towards genuine global security, genuine global interaction, and peaceful relations. Now, there are a lot of problems with the United Nations, but it's the best chance that we've got. We have to understand that this really is, that the world today is the globe is interconnected, and the various nation states are all interconnected to one another. And I am a strong proponent, and the Green Party is a strong proponent of genuine dialogue, diplomacy, and the United Nations is the best way to proceed.
Let's come back to this country, and I mean specifically one of the big issues in the election, especially probably because the Bush campaign has made it this, is the issue of family values. I've heard various little sound bites from people that feel that President Bush, because he's been born again, is and because he says he's in favor of an amendment that would ban gay marriage, that he's therefore their candidate for President of the United States. How would you respond to that kind of statement, and where do family values fit into the 10 key values of the Green Party?
Well, you know, hate is not a family value, Jay, and that's what seems to be driving so much of the Bush agenda. We are proponents of honesty, integrity, transparency in government. You know, the Green Party's and our sense of integrity and morality is strong and unflinching. But we also understand, and in fact driven from our 10 key values of the Green Party, understand that the civil liberties and rights of all people must be respected. I'm proud of the fact that the Green Party supports the legal right, the constitutional right of same-sex people to be married under civil law. You know, that is an argument of equal protection of the law, which is a constitutional guarantee. Now, the Green Party has had this position for a decade. You know, we provided real political leadership on this issue. It's not something that we've just come to recently in order to try to make political hay out of it. We're not embarrassed by it, but we are absolutely committed to providing real leadership and vision. And we're not, and I want to be clear, the Green Party's position, same-sex people have the right to be married under civil law, which means that that all benefits of married people should accrue to same-sex folks. However, we absolutely respect the ability and right of religions to refuse to either conduct or even accept or recognize those marriages. So we're not forcing churches or synagogues or mosques or any other faith communities to accept or recognize or approve of them, but under law, same-sex people have the same rights as others in order to determine if they want to be married.
And I see one of the key virtues, too, of key values is feminism and gender equity. I often wonder if just because women still don't seem to have the equity in employment that was worked for so hard maybe back in the 70s, and of course the Equal Rights Amendment was not passed. What do you think can be done on that front?
Well, one thing is to actually pass an Equal Rights Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Okay.
Another thing would be to ensure that people are paid the same amount for same work. You know, equal pay for equal work is a pretty self-evidently good idea from my perspective. The other thing is that when it comes to a commitment to feminism, it goes beyond just gender equity or gender issues. Real feminism, as a man who considers himself a feminist, understands that feminism is about how we both create and exercise power dynamics. We need to start moving towards power with one another in a cooperative kind of way, rather than the dominator power over each other, where everything has to be a competition where we try to beat other people down. The Green Party is attempting and striving to do politics differently, where all voices are heard, where we genuinely strive for consensus-building exercises, where we try to create a society that works for everyone. Now, I know that that doesn't mean that everybody gets their way, but if we're going to have real democracy where the people rule, all voices must be heard, and ultimately, everyone should feel like that they have a representation in their own government. And the way to do that is to change our voting system so that we use either proportional representation or instant runoff voting to really empower all voters.
Michael Moore, the documentary filmmaker, is on a barnstorming tour across the United States for the next couple weeks, and I think his slogan is Slackers Unite. He's stopping a lot of college campuses and trying to get people that haven't voted before or maybe gave up on voting to decide to express their ideas. In other words, actually make democracy work. Certainly you've been giving us for the last hour a lot of reasons why that maybe the system can change. Is there any other argument you can use with maybe some people you've met on the campaign trail that seem so turned off by politics? Or
Jay, I sure can. Mm-hmm. Let me start with a simple one. Here's a quip. If you don't get turned on to politics, politics will turn on you. And that's what we're seeing today. So I'm telling people, you better get turned on and get involved and get active. Here's another way that I try to challenge folks, especially those who, like you say, have either just disgusted by it and don't do it or quit doing it. And I say this. If you want systemic change in this country and all you do is vote, I'll agree that you're wasting your time. Systemic change does require more than just voting. But there's a corollary to that, Jay, and it goes like this. If you want systemic change in this country and you don't bother to vote for candidates who are articulating and calling for systemic change, then you're obviously wasting an opportunity. And lastly, if you want systemic change in this country and you vote for candidates who are actively opposed to systemic change, then you really are working against your own stated self-interest and your own goals. So I'm encouraging people to register to vote, to get involved and vote. And when you register to vote, I want to make an appeal to progressives. When you register to vote, register into the Green Party. However you choose to ultimately cast your ballot, you should register into the Green Party as a way to signal your dissatisfaction with the corporatization of our culture, of our society, and of our government. Registering into the Green Party, you will be able to join with 500,000 other people across this country who are finding a way to express the fact that we are in active dissent from this corporatized, illegitimate government.
This probably, I guess you'd have to agree that this is one of the most important elections of our lifetimes, huh?
I surely do.
we're coming to the end of the show, and as we did with Michael Badnarik a couple weeks ago, I'd like to give you just 1 minute to summarize the basic points that you want to make. I think you've been it's been very refreshing and very, very informative for me to hear you go over all these points. But I promise to sum up and give your website addresses after your summary.
And I won't do that. I will simply make this appeal to progressive voters. If you want systemic change, you've got to be willing to vote for it. Every other movement in this country that advocated systemic change also came ultimately from alternative third parties. The abolition of slavery, women getting the right to vote, the list goes on and on. And today, if you want the systemic change that the Green Party is advocating, you've got to be willing to vote for it. Those before us went forward even though they were called naive and unrealistic, even though they were called dangerous and un-American, and even if they were called spoilers. So we've got to have that same courage today if we want real systemic change. What other people call spoiling, Greens call participating. We are going to exercise our democratic right to participate. And if anybody believes that our participation is a problem, the solution to that problem really can't be to restrict the voice of the Green Party or to forbid voters from exercising the choice. We need more voices and more choices, not fewer. So the solution is to change the voting system to instant runoff voting. Voters in Michigan, please get involved with efforts to change our voting system. You can check that group out at the Center for Voting and Democracy at www.fairvote.org. But if you want change, you got to be willing to vote for change. The Green Party and David Cobb and Patricia LaMarche represent that kind of change.
Thank you so much for being with us on WHFR Journal this morning. David Cobb, presidential candidate for the Green Party. And this is Jay Kornick saying, let's continue to keep stirring things up out there. And thank you, Susan Morrell, too, for being with us.
Little darling, it's been a long, long time. candidates will spend nearly $2 billion this year to measure you, then tailor their images to fit what they think you'll buy. It's an endless manipulative process designed to strip us of the facts we need. This election, see the candidates as they are. Get the facts, not the spin. From Project Vote Smart, call 888-VOTE-SMART or go online, vote-smart.org. Don't just vote, vote smart.
Dick Alfonsi with you here at WHFR Dearborn, and I'll be playing big band music until 2 o'clock. If you have a song or artist you'd like to hear from, give me a call at 313-845-9676 or 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that she turns out to be someone who'll watch over me. I'm a little lamb who's lost in the wood. I know I could always be good to